Blog Talk Radio.
Listening to This Week in Health Innovation on the Blog Talk Radio and Affiliate Networks. Welcome to the show. I'm the creator and producer, co-host, and I'm flying solo today. This Week in Health Innovation is brought to you by Health Innovation Media, where we monitor the innovation impulse from idea to business model and emerging best practices. On the broadcast today, we are very fortunate to chat with physician, researcher, and entrepreneur Amy Baxter, MD, who's the founder and CEO of a company called MMJ Labs, which is dedicated to personal pain control. And as is often the case in the innovation economy, skin in the game appears to be a driver for Dr. Baxter, who notes, as a pain researcher, my son had unnecessarily traumatic routine vaccinations. I knew there must be a better way, so I invented, tested, got over $1 million in grant funding, researched, and ultimately developed manufacturing for Buzzy and other personal pain products. And according to MMJ Labs' website, Buzzy is a reusable breakthrough personal pain device that provides natural pain relief. Gait control is the basis for Buzzy, physiologically overwhelming the body's pain nerves with benign cold, ice wings, and vibration Buzzy's body. Like a dentist jiggling a jaw or putting a burned finger under cool water, cold and vibration control, sharp pain from shots, cosmetic injections and IVs, and temporarily relieve muscle soreness and burning from medications. Independently verified research shows Buzzy works. So with that very brief introduction, Amy Baxter, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. You nailed it.
Well, good. I practice. So I think this is an enormously timely chat today. But before we get to sort of the gestalt, if you will, of the context and for what you do and why it's so very important public health-wise, tell us a little bit about you. Who are you? And start with your calling to medicine and chart your path forward. Give us a high-level overview.
Well, it starts when I was 4 years old. For most doctors, they knew they wanted to be a physician very early. And it probably did start about four for me when I knew that I wanted to be the one who was on the stoop of our street with a bottle of Mercurochrome and a Band-Aid. If your listeners still remember what Mercurochrome was, but if somebody got hurt, I wanted to be the one to fix it. And so that other people interpreted for me was the nature of being a doctor. So I grew up knowing that I wanted to be a doctor because I wanted to be the one who was there to fix something. When I was in medical school, I got a real interest. And I guess I should say when in undergrad, I was a barefoot doctor. We would go around to different dorm rooms distributing mostly ibuprofen and condoms. But it kind of reinforced that I liked taking care of people and that healthcare aspect. So in medical school, I went to Emory University in Atlanta, and I got to do some international medicine, which, again, kind of being on the forefront of trying to reduce suffering and trying to help people. And then residency in pediatrics, I started noticing that while we had topical anesthetics and we had ways to decrease our patients' pain, we really weren't doing that nearly as often as we could have. So nobody likes hearing a child cry. And when I realized that we had really effective ways to decrease the pain, particularly for needle sticks, I started researching why people didn't do that. When I went into fellowship in pediatric emergency medicine, I decided to go the route of being a researcher. And the first thing I did was realize that all of the studies that prove that different things block pain really didn't drive the needle, so to speak, to get doctors to uptake those procedures. So my first studies were looking at how using pain relief actually increases efficacy, specifically for lumbar punctures in neonates. If a child has a really high fever, they'll often get a spinal tap or lumbar puncture. And even though we have a cream that blocks the pain of it, people didn't use the cream. So my first study was really to prove that when you did use the pain control, you had a higher success rate. And so that was my first big paper. And since then, in the trying to decrease needle pain, since I fancied myself something of an expert, when my son had his four-year-old shot, he'd always been a good shot taker, and I knew that I had creams and I had ways to distract him and that we could continue him being proud of his success. Unfortunately, the nurse who was giving the shots was very unimpressed with the concept of pain relief. She said, you know, that cream doesn't work. She ripped it off, stared it in the eyes, and said, you better sit there and be still or this is really going to hurt, and then jabbed home four injections. So after that, he wasn't so good with shots, and that was really where my academic interest in pain management shifted into being a very practical one and specifically oriented to vaccine pain.
So let me ask you about the efficacy of the hypothesis. If one takes out the pain factor, do you have increasing, quote, compliance with vaccination?
So that is really the crux of the issue. And in some ways, connecting the dots is only now being done with the research. We know that when people are afraid of needles, that they're less likely to give blood. They did a target study in 2012 asking people who had not gotten their flu shot why they didn't. And 25% of people who don't get flu shots said it was because they were afraid of needles. So we know that if you're afraid of needles, then you're less compliant. The connection between pain and fear is a little bit more difficult. We got NIH funding, as you mentioned, because I never really intended to start a business. I really wanted to solve the problem for my kid. So when I'd come up with this vibrating cold thing and tried it on my kid, the shots didn't hurt, and he became less anxious about needles to the point where he's 17 now, but his HPV shots didn't even bother him. And so when we were going through this process, when I had the prototype, I tried to get people interested so that they could make the device and run with it while I kept being a doctor, and no one valued needle pain. Everyone said that's just not a big enough problem, so there's no reason to make a product to solve it. So in order to prove that the product not only was needed, but it worked, I had to get a grant. And the SBIR is an NIH grant for Small Business Innovations and Research. You can't get the grant unless you form a company. So in many ways, it was the exact opposite route to entrepreneurship that many people take. I had a solution, and in order to test it, I actually had to form a company. So how did the circling back to the question of pain and compliance, there is definite research that people are less compliant with more painful injections, and that when they switch to medicines that are less painful, they're more likely to stick with them. In arthritis, that happens often, that people will try a more painful medication, but when it hurts too much, they'll switch to a different medicine that hurts less to inject. When I had the data from the Buzzy studies, we noticed that the children endorsed more pain the more injections they had. Now, on the surface, that seems kind of obvious. I mean, the distress and how much pain they said increases. If you get stung by five wasps rather than one wasp, that's a lot worse with five. So when we did the study and saw that's interesting, you know, they all say what's most correlated with pain was really how many they had. So then I went back and I looked at the kids' level of fear and found that the amount of fear they had as a 10 or 11-year-old was strongly correlated with how many shots they got at once as a kid. The interesting thing was, if they only got one or two injections at a time, only 9% of those kids were afraid at their 10, 11-year-old shots. But when they got four injections at a time, 42% of them said they were severely afraid of needles. So it looks like there is definitely a correlation between how many shots you get at once and the number of shots correlates with pain. So at this point in the research, that's kind of where we stand. Until we start giving pain relief to kids who are getting injections at that critical 4 to 6-year-old age, we won't really be able to prove prospectively that decreasing pain increases your compliance as an adult.
Yeah, stories unfold.
It's convoluted.
Right. And I'm just wondering, maybe as a broad reference here, when you embarked upon this journey to make a difference, to make it better, how far did the needle move? 20%, 30%, 40%? Where are we relative to maybe one more obstacle being taken out of doing the right thing?
Well, Anna Cadio published a study in 2008 that found that only 6% of pediatricians use anything for pain, including Tylenol. I think that she's in Canada, and Canada has gone a really long way in raising the awareness that pain relief matters. There have been a lot of studies looking at infant pain that find that sucrose and giving something sweet right during their immunizations or allowing breastfeeding decreases pain. But there haven't been any follow-up studies, and I think that in some ways the anti-vaccine movement has galvanized pediatricians to be more dogmatic about we have to get these shots in, we've got to do the shots all at once, and the willingness to introduce pain management hasn't moved as much as we'd like.
Mm-hmm. Right, and of course the anti-vax movement isn't helping much from a public health perspective.
Well, exactly, and so that's the question. Then once you've got this push, do you push back or do you try to broaden the discussion to figure out where the genesis of this came from? There's a really interesting study that Dan Salmon did in 2005, because we were already well into vaccine refusal by concerned parents at that point. And when he compared the groups of the people who were fully vaccinating parents versus non-vaccine adherent parents, and looked at what the biggest philosophical differences were, the people who weren't vaccinating their kids fully were afraid of the immunogenicity of the vaccine, meaning that they were afraid that it was a big vaccine load, that it was a lot for the body to cope with, and they were also afraid from actual damage from vaccines. You know, am I going to give my kid flu by giving him a flu vaccine? Am I going to give him this disease? Is it possible that even the broken up parts of the disease that are in a vaccine will make him sick? So those two things were what they were afraid of, immunogenicity and damage from the vaccine. Ironically, the vaccine that those partial immunizers were least likely to refuse was polio, which is super weird if you look at it from a vaccine standpoint, because it is extremely immunogenic, and it's also the one that could cause some people to get polio back when we were giving the oral form. But when they did this study, the people they were surveying, polio was an oral vaccine. So even though the parents said they were worried about immunogenicity and damage, in reality, they were most willing to take an oral vaccine, not an injected one. So I think that that's critical in this whole anti-vaccine debate because, you know, one has to wonder if all the vaccines were oral or painless or a patch, would we be having as much fervor and as much emotion surrounding the issue. And I really think that it wouldn't be as big a deal if there wasn't this dissonance between watching your kid get stuck multiple times and that feeling wrong. Even if you intellectually know that vaccines save your child's life in an epidemic and keep the community safe, that intellectual knowledge is hard-pressed to overcome this cringing that any parent would get watching their child in pain.
So lots of cross currents there for me. Last night I was watching a PBS series, American Experience, on the forgotten plague, tuberculosis. Mm. And some part of the narrative I'm hearing in the vaccination, anti-vaccination exchange is that vaccines have they've been too successful, you know, in the sense of disassociating people with the risk of not vaccinating until it crops up from a public health perspective, which is less of an immediate driver as to my choice as a parent, which is part of the anti-vax narrative. Is that any of that make sense?
Yeah, well, clearly, I mean, no one is seeing people with polio. No one is having to keep their child from going swimming in a public pool because they're worried about polio. So without those fears, it's very easy to see a child with autism and go, I know someone who looks like that. I don't know if it's caused by a vaccine, but I've never seen measles and I have seen autism. So regardless of the statistics and risk-benefit and the fact that autism's connection to measles or thimerosal has been as thoroughly disproven as the Cottingley fairies were. It doesn't really matter. If you're not looking at polio in front of your face every day, and you are looking at things that are scary, and so without the years that it takes to learn immunology, you can almost see the logic. The other thing that's really emotionally driving, I think, the current anti-vaccine movement is when most parents today were born, we only got 6 injections before we were 2 years old. That was all the vaccines we had. But now we can protect against so many diseases. We now have about 36 different injections that kids get before they're 6. So there is, no one talks about that, but I think that there is an emotional response that many parents are having, feeling like, man, that's a lot of shots, because they don't have a recollection of having that many shots when they were a kid. And there are more shots. Mm. And as we showed in our research, when you get more injections at once and you're old enough to remember, it does have an effect on how you approach healthcare later. So I think that this is a discussion that hopefully will be prompted by the anti-vaccine fervor. You know, it's not just you're hurting my child, you're making me risk my child, free choice. There is something to be discussed in how we're giving vaccines and how many we're giving. And unless we are willing to be seen as a pediatric entity, as someone that cares about that and is paying attention to that, then we're not going to be able to get the trust of parents who have a feeling that there are too many vaccines, so then they start picking and choosing based on reasons of TV stars and PR rather than actual reasons of science.
Well, so given that there are more tools in the preventive toolbox, going from you know, our parents' experience to where options available today, which some might say borders on excessive in terms of choice and risk-benefit matchup decisions, will that choices be made any better or be informed by precision medicine, genomics? You know, is there a value add there?
Yeah. I think what the technology that's really going to push this is when we're able to give vaccines painlessly. Because even when parents say, this is why I'm not giving this vaccine or I'm afraid of this, the truth of the matter is vaccines have such a tiny, tiny immunogenic load now. Even with all of them together, we're still giving less intense immunology to the bloodstream and to the body's immune system. So when we're able to give it painlessly, I think it'll be easier for parents to look at the true amount of how little it takes for the body to fight and to incorporate the knowledge from the vaccines, as opposed to how much it takes for the body to fight one single disease. So I think that I really don't think that we're going to get to a place where we are genomically choosing who gets what vaccine, because vaccines are enormously adaptive, viruses are enormously adaptive, and the vaccines that work for them are not going to need to be tailored to individual people. We need to have a base herd immunity. We need to have people who are immunized against the diseases that kill kids. I think that there are even now some vaccines which are given to children that are at higher risk. RSV is given to newborns with heart disease, or babies that are born prematurely. So it's a vaccine, but the Board of Pediatrics is actually phenomenal and has some amazing scientists who look at the risk-benefit from what vaccines are created and what societally is, both in terms of suffering, in terms of hospitalizations, and in terms of loss of life, what makes sense to add. So the AAP does block vaccines. RSV is only indicated for the children who are at risk of getting that disease, and so we're able in that way to section out who gets what vaccine, but I don't think we're going to get to a place where it's like you are particularly susceptible to these 3 diseases, so you only get those vaccines.
So not entirely clear, but we're early in the game as to the ultimate value add of precision medicine, quote-unquote.
Yeah, I don't think precision medicine is going to have as much of an impact in the way that we vaccinate or in what vaccines children need.
Okay. So let's circle back to this pain-free notion, which seems to anchor what you're doing at Buzzy. Talk a little bit about the value add there and perhaps couch it in some of the research findings from an empirical perspective.
All right. Well, one thing we found in our study was that when kids get two vaccines on multiple different occasions when they're between age 4 and 6, they're less likely to be afraid. So total pain management is not necessarily the goal. Often I get pushback from people who say, well, it's just a little pinprick. It's a tiny bit of pain. Kids need to get used to it. I think that one of my big messages now is that if you're not using pain control, then when you give 3, 4, or 5 injections at once, you're causing something that is a trauma that today's adults never had to deal with. And 1 or 2 shots, you may cry, you may get over it and feel fine because you've had an empowering experience. But when it starts getting to being overwhelmed, 3, 4, or 5, then the pain starts to really matter. So if we need to keep giving that number for our pediatrician's sake, right now it's an insurance issue as well. If we are going to keep giving that number, then I think that decreasing the pain makes an enormous amount of difference in how these kids grow up and whether or not they choose to give blood and to get their flu shots and to get preventative health when they get older. Now, from a chronic disease standpoint, a lot of people using Buzzy are using it just because there is something called needle fatigue. And if you're giving yourself in vitro shots every day, if you have to give your 3-year-old daily injections of insulin, or if you have to give your 4-year-old injections of a really painful medicine for juvenile arthritis or Crohn's, then you start to get worn out by that whole ordeal of painful injections that aren't going away. You can't grow out of them. And so for those people, Buzzy has been shown to decrease the pain of flu vaccines by 72%. For people that are getting injections like IVF or injections for arthritis are using it not because they're afraid of needles, but just because it gets exhausting and it adds to the burden of the disease to have something painful happen so often.
So that brings up for me 2 things. One is from an integrative standpoint, the absence of pain, more of a holistic approach to intervening medically or therapeutically on a case-specific basis. And secondly, this whole, if I don't have bad memories, and I just tweeted, I hope I paraphrased you properly, if we don't have bad memories or painful memories of what it means to go to the doctor as a child, perhaps we won't roll that forward. And in today's vernacular, we'd be a little more inclined to engage, if you will, in proper health behaviors so that the population health measure goes up in, you know, incrementally because we're doing the right thing. I mean, is that too much of a stretch or am I connecting dots here that can be connected?
No, that's actually, there's 2 really good points about what you say. One thing is that pain is a holistic experience. Pain is not just physical pain. It is also fear, and it's how much attention you're paying to it. This is why Lamaze is helpful, because it gives people something to focus on other than the pain. It also gives a sense of control because you're doing something during labor by controlling your breathing. So the pain control of using Buzzy is not just cold and vibration. It's not just making your body feel a different set of sensations. Like when you bump your elbow and you rub it, you're feeling the rubbing much more than the pain, so the pain goes away. I think part of what's been important to learn about Buzzy is that the empowerment that people who are giving themselves shots or people who are going to the doctor and afraid of shots, the empowerment of having something that they can do to decrease pain, it feeds into the whole holistic experience of the pain itself. And the other thing is just simply having to put Buzzy on and holding it for 30 seconds or a minute before you give the injection, that takes the attention away from the shot itself and gives your mind something else to focus on. So all 3 of those areas of fear and focus and pain relief are most effective. Now, the other part of what you said that's important is we're learning about something called adverse childhood events and toxic stress. And what these are is that there's a cumulative effect when you have deeply disturbing situations, divorce, moving, abuse as a child, that impact your health later. While I don't think that for most people immunizations, even given a lot at once, cause the same kind of toxic stress that affects their health later, it unquestionably ties in with this research that shows that early childhood events have impacts on how you deal with things the rest of your life. Every single person who I have talked to who has needle phobia can pinpoint, no pun intended, a time, it's hard, can pinpoint a time where they had a really bad experience at the doctor, and that is almost always between ages 4 and 6. And those people do go on to not go to the doctor. The thing about the number of increased injections that is a little bit concerning for public health is that up until 2000, only 25% of children said they were afraid of needles. And the number now is 63%.
Wow.
If you look at that increase in fear, it totally matches the curve of the increased number of vaccines. And there's good data that people that are afraid of needles don't go to the doctor as often. So I'm afraid we have a public health tsunami that's coming when these children who were born in the year 2000 and later, because that's when we peaked out at the number of vaccines, when those kids get old enough to decide whether they want to go to the doctor or donate blood or have a flu shot, I'm afraid that the research that is out there now about needle fear says that a lot of those people are not only not going to go to the doctor, they're not going to vaccinate their own kids.
Which really, in my view, if you take the health policy or health economic side of the equation into that narrative, is very disturbing, because so much of what we're moving towards is this increase of personal health accountability, accountable care, population health management, really looking at creating incentives by making the patient or the member more responsible for first dollar costs, therefore more inclined to do things that are going to make their engagement with the acute healthcare system less likely. So if people aren't, you hear patient engagement or medication adherence or compliance, which are words that many, quote, e-patients revile. If you mix up those two, it's a bad combination, because it seems like one is arguing against the other.
Well, I've spoken to several executives with healthcare, HMOs, and with insurance companies, because obviously it'd be great for us to be able to get Buzzy covered for people that need it. And they say that they're seeing an interesting phenomenon that people in their early 20s are overwhelmingly choosing extremely high deductible and not even preventative health care in their plans. And many of them say, I have to do this legally, but I don't need to put any money in for going to the doctor, because I have no intentions of going. I don't like doctors. I don't like shots.
There you go. So we have a few minutes remaining, and I'm just wondering if you might comment on the fact that it looks like, your academic researcher, pediatrician, who's moved into essentially the entrepreneurial space. Was that much of a stretch for you, or did it just come naturally?
Oh, it's a stretch every day. I feel so much more comfortable when I go to the hospital, because I really know what I'm doing there. When I'm in the entrepreneur world, everything is new and different. But the thing is, Greg, that I feel so strongly that the advocacy of what we're doing and giving people an option to start taking medicine again, a way to protect their kids, that it's important enough that it needs to be done. So we have been running our company in a way that isn't the traditional entrepreneurial way. We're not taking VC. We're insisting that it be reusable, because everyone who's wanted to run Buzzy from a corporate in a capitalistic way has said you've got to have disposable ice wings. You can't just let parents go home and use this for their child's entire life. And yet that's really more where we're going. We feel like it's important to have Buzzy be a product that everyday families can have, that you don't have to be dependent on the doctor for a prescription. So the practical parts of moving to being an entrepreneur have been ratcheting and slow learning of something that's foreign. But I think that the philosophical underpinnings of why we're doing it are very simpatico with the reasons that I became a doctor in the first place.
Well, well said, Dr. Amy Baxter. Thank you so much for your time today on broadcast. Appreciate
Thank
your
you.
Insights, and How old is the company? Where are you located?
We're in Atlanta, Georgia. And we're at buzzyforshots.com on the internet with lots of information about needle phobia, how to decrease needle pain, things besides Buzzy, but a lot of good resources for patients.
Okay. Well, that'll have to be the last word for today's broadcast. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Amy Baxter, for her time and insights today. Follow her on Twitter via @AmyBaxterMD, as well as @Buzzy4Shots. And again, check them out on the web at buzzyforshots.com. We do this weekly at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern on Wednesdays. Join us next week for another episode of This Week in Health Innovation. We'll hear from tech entrepreneur and Startup Health Academy participant Jean Ann Booth about her Kickstarter campaign for Unali Wear, which focus groups have labeled an OnStar for seniors. Until then, this is Greg Masters saying bye now.